Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope you're having a nice day today, wherever you are.
And we are kind of going pretty deep into writing today. I mean, we're always talking about writing on Writers' Voices, but we're going a little deeper maybe than we sometimes do. Do you want to introduce our guest?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Our guest today is Mark Graham, and he is an author, actor, story coach, shamanic practitioner, and developer of Runes for Writers storytelling tools. When not on stage, in the studio, or bound to his computer, he can be found traipsing about Colorado's Front Range with his wife and their Greater Swiss Mountain Dog. Sounds like fun. So this book is called Runes for Writers, R-U-N-E-S, for Writers. And I had never heard of such a thing, so I'm anxious to have him just explain this.
So Runes for Writers, Boost Your Creativity and Destroy Writer's Block, which is a book being published this year, 2020. And also we're going to be talking about Mark's most recent novel, Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
So let's just start at the beginning. What are runes for writers?
So the runes, the Norse runes, are in their simplest form. They are the writing system, the alphabet, if you will, of the ancient Norse and Germanic peoples, similar to how our alphabet, the name actually comes from the first two letters, alpha, beta. The Greek alphabet, the elder Futhark, is named for the first six characters or sound values in the Norse writing system. At a deeper level, and similar to all writing systems in their fundamental stages, the runes have been used and are continually used even today as divination tools, similar to, say, the tarot, for example. Where each rune can be carved on a stick of wood, a tile, printed on cards or what have you. And then each rune has a specific meaning, a literal meaning of what the rune is. It has more of a symbolic meaning. And then that symbolism then launches into a whole range of meanings, depending on the particular situation that is being cast for. And so I've taken this age-old, literally millennia-old tradition and looked at, how can we use these to boost creativity in a divinatory system. As with any divinatory system, we're really just tapping into different levels of consciousness, and storytelling is nothing if not tapping into a different level of consciousness, so that creativity. So they felt like a really natural pairing, and the work I've done on my own and with other writers has really proven this out, that by kind of developing this relationship with the runes, we can really deepen our connection to our own muse and that source of creativity within us.
What got you interested in runes in the first place?
So I've been a student of, let's just say, esoteric wisdom for many, many years. I began, had a rather fundamentalist Christian upbringing. So my first forays into this world were in the Western Christian mysticism, Western magical traditions, and so on. And I kept being pulled deeper and deeper and deeper back into history, if you will. My novels to date have all been historical novels, so I have a real tie and a fascination with the history of civilizations, of humanity as a whole, and particularly the history of spiritual or religious development. And so I've looked into the systems of my own heritage. I have Graham is a Scottish name. So I've looked into the Celtic mysticism, Druidry, and other systems like that. But then I recently discovered that I actually have actually more of a Norse heritage, and so I wanted to really explore what that looks like and what those systems were. So I began studying the runes and found a very deep connection with them. I have a daily mindfulness practice, a meditation practice, and so as I was beginning to get familiar with the runes, I took 6 months. There are 24 runes in the Elder Futhark, and so I took one rune a week, so 24 weeks, most of 6 months, and just focused on one rune each week as the center point of my meditation. And through the around the midpoint of that process, this notion of using the runes as a creativity tool just kind of sprang into my mind and almost fully developed. And within just a few weeks, I'd really dived into that, explored it, and more or less pulled together the system as we have it now.
One thing that I found really interesting, I hadn't really thought about before, is where the word alphabet came from, alpha, beta.
Yeah. And,
but, I mean, why did that never occur to me before? But are there
I have a very nerdy relationship with words, so that's you're not unique in that.
Are there other kind of mystical systems that are based on essentially letters of an alphabet, or are the runes unique in that respect?
I think I suspect, I couldn't say for sure, but I would suspect that some of the East Asian writing systems, probably Egyptian hieroglyphs as well, had a longer running connection. You know, it's interesting, writing was seen as magic when it first came out. And when someone would spell a word, they were literally casting a spell to the minds of the kind of unschooled people around them. And so they have a really long, whether it's truly a magical, mystical system, or whether, you know, the people who didn't know what to make of these characters simply saw it that way as some kind of magic that these scribes had to communicate thoughts across distances to complete strangers. You know, writing systems in their early stages all had kind of that magical aura about them.
Now, there you go again. I never thought about spelling and spells as being connected.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. The history is fun. This is why I love historical fiction.
Now, Mark, you've written 3 historical fiction novels, or mm-hmm. published 3 of them. Are any of them set in the Norse environment and when these runes were being used?
To date, they haven't. All 3 of those were written well before I really kind of stumbled across the runes. I do have at least one novel. I have a couple, several novels actually that would tie into that Celtic heritage. I have one that would be right at the end of the Norse or the Viking age, but I'm definitely open to the muse bringing me some more.
So the 3 that you have published, where are they set? What in what time and what part of the world?
Sure. So they're kind of all over the place. I've generally, you know, I write the story that comes to me, not necessarily playing to the market per se. But the first novel, Of Ashes and Dust, is set in and around the American Civil War era, the Civil War, and then later in the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. My second novel is Song of Songs, a novel of the Queen of Sheba. So that is set in the Middle East, Egypt, Arabia, and Israel, Palestine, about 1000 BCE, in the biblical age, the time of King Solomon. And then my latest novel, Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, is set in the early 7th century, so 610 to 620 or so, both in Visigothic Spain and in the Maya New World in the Honduras-Guatemala area.
I have to ask, how are you able to accumulate enough understanding of all those different time periods and places in the world? Do you try and be historically accurate, or is it just too much?
No, I try to be as accurate as possible. You know, there are obviously the Civil War era is well documented. So I was able for Of Ashes and Dust to look into newspaper articles, to letters home from soldiers, memoirs, diaries of people and newspaper accounts who had been in specific battles. So while my protagonist is a fictional character, it was relatively easy to drop him into the middle of actual battles where we have, as accurate as any recollection can be, you know, snippets of conversations that were actually taking place in these battles. You know, we knew of the technology and all the things. So that was actually the easiest one to research, although because the information is so prevalent, any errors are very easily pointed out to me after the fact by rabid historical fans. The other two, you know, obviously from 3,000 years ago, our primary source for the Queen of Sheba story are religious accounts. So there's the Bible, the Ethiopian dynastic tradition, their national legend, the Kevra Nagast, or the Book of the Glory of Kings. There are accounts of the Queen of Sheba in the Quran and in Arabic literature. So obviously all of those are very fantastical and have a definite political or religious agenda behind them. So from the story perspective, I really had to kind of go through the lens, backward through the lens of what were the objectives, what were the biases of these people who told these stories, and then try to work backward through those biases to what might the story actually be. However, the facts of the matter, you know, we know we have solid archaeological evidence of the culture of the time. You know, for example, we know that Israel was not a monotheist culture during the period that's associated with the reign of King Solomon. There are shrines in every home with multiple gods and goddesses, figurines or clay idols that were in every home and courtyard. So that sort of thing, you know, what sort of weapons did they have? Did they have ironworking? As I was researching the Maya culture, this is well into in the Middle Ages. So ironworking, of course, was prevalent in Europe. But I had to watch my language, if you will, when writing from the Maya point of view, because they did not have steel. They did not have ironworking. So I specifically recall, and maybe it's a cliche phrase, so it's just as well I pulled it out of the book, but you know, my character, you know, she steeled her spine. They didn't have steel, so she couldn't do that. So in that regard, I tried to be as accurate as possible and not have obvious anachronisms. But where I'm looking at characterization, relationships among people and so on, I think humans, while our technology, our society, the tools we use have evolved over the millennia, I think the way we, on a fundamental level, relate to one another is very similar to what we have today.
Now, in Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, there's certainly an element of mysticism or fantasy in some sense. Is that true of your other books as well?
To a degree, yes. In the other books, it can be couched. You know, you could almost get away, well, he was just dreaming, or he had a hallucination or a waking vision or something of that nature. But yes, in Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, I definitely go to take a greater leap of the imagination into mysticism, almost, as you said, fantastical elements of the story. And, you know, that kind of reflects my worldview. I think technology has replaced what, you know, the function that magic once served for us. As I go into in the neuroscience and the new physics that I go into in Runes for Writers, there are multiple levels of consciousness that we work on. We're mostly grounded in the ordinary consciousness that we, you know, how we experience the world, interact with other people, with the environment around us. But we have access to far deeper and more universal levels of consciousness. And I think in ancient times, when technology was not so prevalent, when we weren't so bound to the intellect and to the ordinary consciousness, I think we had a greater access to those other levels of consciousness that, looking back on them from our modern perspective, we see as more mystical and magical.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mark Graham, author of Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, and also Runes for Writers, Boost Your Creativity and Destroy Writer's Block. So, Mom, when you were looking at Runes for Writers, I know that you mentioned that the discussions of consciousness was something that that appealed to you.
Yes, I really, the runes thing was a little bit beyond my intelligence, but the consciousness and subconscious and unconscious voices that we are, you know, related to was very interesting to me. And could you explain that a little bit, how they work together?
Sure. So we are multidimensional beings, if you want to put it this way, you know, and I go back to and this is not something new. This is not a new age invention. If you look at Plato, Plato described the realm of ideas or the realm of ideals, which was a non-physical realm or a plane where, let's say, the idea of an oak tree existed, it's simply as an idea, as a symbol. And then when we in the physical realm look at an oak tree, we're really looking at that idea, let's say, just poking through the veil of our sensory reality, accreting physical material around it until it looks more or less like that ideal oak tree. And that happens millions and millions of times across thousands and thousands of species, plant, animal, mineral, what have you. And so, you know, that idea and that notion of these other realms has grown through the ages. And in the early civilizations, you know, it was the place of the shaman, of the druid, of the magic worker, the medicine worker, to go into these realms. You know, we all do it. We do it every day when we're dreaming, while we sleep, when we're daydreaming, when we should be working. You know, as writers, when we tap into that story idea, you know, the shamans used to go on, they call them shamanic journeys. And they would use the drum. Sometimes they would use botanical aids to enter these altered states of consciousness, where they would look for solutions to problems. Where are the game? Why is this person ill? Things like that. But as writers, we are also tapping into, we're doing exactly the same thing. We're journeying into this magical, unmanifest realm of our story. We're bringing back that information and we're bringing it into physical reality on the page. So it's, and that may be, I won't say a discovery or an invention, but that realization that, you know, writers are modern shamans. You know, we are the magic workers, the dream walkers, the journeyers into these other realms of consciousness, and the world builders, the bridge builders between, let's say, the ordinary humanity and this dreamscape where the muses live.
And of course, when you're reading and you get caught up into an alternative world, it's like you really do travel and see and experience something.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is part of the magic of story. And I that's why I love it so much.
You said that when you create, you're reaching into your unconscious mind, mm-hmm. then your subconscious brings that idea to the forefront, and then mm-hmm. your conscious mind works on it. So it's really interesting. It really is.
Yeah, and we have, you know, and those are, and I really simplified it, really, so that I could grasp it well enough to try to explain it to others. And we have at least, we operate as human beings on at least 9 levels of consciousness. You know, those are the unconscious, subconscious, and ordinary consciousness are the most obvious players in the storyteller's toolbox. But that realm of consciousness is multidimensional, and really we begin talking quantum physics, theoretical physics, neuroscience at this point, and frankly, a depth conversation is beyond even of what I'm able to really fully grasp.
And how do you connect all that to the runes?
The runes are a mnemonic device, if you will. What we're really trying to do, and it can be done numerous ways. I won't say that the runes are holding a specific or magical value, unique in anything else, whether it's the runes, tarot cards, you know, some people will use lucid dreaming for all this, but they all serve the same purpose. And that's to allow, really to, one, distract the ordinary consciousness so that, you know, for shorthand, I'll call it the left brain. You know, that left logical, the editor, as opposed to the right brain, which is more nonlinear, creative, you know, the storyteller aspect. So when we're struggling with the creative process, usually it's because the left brain is trying to ground everything in the ordinary world, in our outer world of the senses, of physical reality. And that's highly counterproductive to the creative process because, you know, by its very nature, we're looking at things that don't exist and we're trying to bring them into this world. And the left brain will have none of it. It just doesn't play that game. And so the runes in particular and other, let's say, divinatory systems, their power is in kind of distracting and detaching the left brain while deepening and strengthening the connection between the subconscious and the unconscious, but also with our willpower. You know, we can send, I call the subconscious, the concierge, or the research librarian. And so with a definite order, to that, you know, I want to solve this story problem. I want to understand this character. I want to figure out this scene. With that kind of direction, then the subconscious can go and find that information, find the solution in the unconscious mind. And the rune cards, or the runes in particular, serve as kind of a shorthand, as a semaphore, if you will, a code language, so that rather than saying that a character has mommy issues, if you will, that either she or her mother have neglected that role of the nurturer and the caretaker, and maybe even describing that instance, it brings back the rune Berkano reversed, which has exactly that same meaning. So it's really that shorthand that the unconscious understands and is able to, you know, just instead of writing out 5 pages of narrative, it just hands the subconscious a rune, upright or reversed, comes back, and that the meaning of that rune then is can be extrapolated into that larger story idea.
So the individual has many facets, many ways of retrieving information we don't even know we have.
Yes.
In our subconscious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
You know, I mean, we are information animals. You know, we thrive on information, and the world around us is sending us signals, even just from the ordinary world. You know, I'm getting light from the sun and reflections off of buildings and passing cars. I'm getting the sounds of my environment, from the air conditioner to passing traffic to airplanes flying overhead. You know, I'm getting tons and tons of information at every moment, and most of that is filtered out. You know, but it's similar to police investigations will do this, for example, where they will sometimes enlist hypnotists to aid in interviewing witnesses, because the witness has the information. If they were there, all that raw information was brought into their awareness on that unconscious level. And through hypnotism, for example, they can more easily access that information and bring out, you know, the face of a suspect, or the direction the car was moving, or the license plate tag, things of that nature that the ordinary conscious is not aware of, but that information has been received and tucked away. And in that altered state of consciousness, that it can be brought back up and brought into the ordinary reality.
Well, it's like our guest a couple of weeks ago, Christina Adams, author of Camel Crazy, said intuition is really just pattern recognition, that you have all this information stored that you're not even aware that you have, and your intuition is putting it together and bringing it up to the conscious level.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. So do you want to read a little bit from Runes for Writers to give people more of a flavor of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And this will kind of feed into Caroline's earlier questions. This is from the chapter on creativity and writer's block, where I really dig into, I kind of lay the foundation for these different levels of consciousness and how they interact with the creative process. So understanding how to most effectively use the Runes for Writers system requires at least a cursory knowledge of the nature of creativity. Now, a storyteller doesn't have to know all the intricacies of consciousness and the human mind any more than someone has to be an auto mechanic to drive a car. Should the car break down, however, a mechanic will have a decided advantage in getting unstuck and back on the road than the run-of-the-mill driver. Similarly, the storyteller, who understands how the creative process works, will be far more skilled in keeping her creative engine in top form and getting back on track should things go awry. The first thing to understand is the nature of human consciousness. A human being operates on at least 9 different levels of consciousness. Some of these we share in common with animals and so-called lower life forms. Other levels of consciousness are distinctly human, while others we share with beings on an even higher evolutionary scale. Fair warning, this discussion may seem a bit woo-woo, but the principles we'll be exploring have been understood by truly integrated human beings for thousands of generations. Jung and Freud and later depth psychologists caught glimpses of these truths and brought them closer to the mainstream. Today, neuroscientists and quantum physicists are beginning to formulate theories to span the gulf between the inner and outer worlds that the wise ones have known for millennia. And if I seem to be leading you into the deep esoteric woods, just stick with me and trust we'll all come out safe on the other side. With regard to story, we're mainly concerned with the ordinary consciousness, the subconscious, and the unconscious mind. The superconscious and higher consciousness also come into play, but these primarily interact with the unconscious, so for the scope of this practice, we'll just stick with the first three. The ordinary consciousness is that level of awareness we normally associate with everyday waking consciousness. This is the active mind that thinks and feels and interacts with the world around you. The unconscious mind is deeply hidden within the psyche, but is the single most powerful level of consciousness for physical beings. When we hear the adage that we only use 5 to 10% of our brains, really our minds, the unconscious mind takes up the vast majority of the other 90 to 95%. And neuroscientists posit that the brain receives upward of 11 million pieces of information every second. To put this in perspective, if each piece of information were worth 1 cent, the neural input to the United States populace would pay off the national debt in just over half a second.
If only.
Now, we're obviously not aware of all this information. If even 1% of that data made it into the ordinary consciousness, we'd all be catatonic from sensory overload. But every one of these data points is received, archived, spindled, and mutilated by the unconscious mind. This is the ultimate data storage facility, the clearinghouse of human experience. Now, the subconscious mind acts as the research librarian, the go-between from the unconscious mind to the ordinary consciousness. The information retrieved rests in the ordinary consciousness for a time, the short-term memory bin, before being returned to its place in the stacks. A repetition of certain thought patterns, physically represented by synaptic pathways in the brain, boosts the efficiency of recall, such as for birthdays, telephone numbers, driving directions, etc. Those inputs that are beneficial for physical survival, for example, the screech of brakes and the blare of the horn from a truck barreling down on you, are given priority status. These may be relayed to the ordinary consciousness, or more likely, straight to the brainstem for immediate processing and action. The importance granted and the speed of transmission goes rapidly downhill from there. The location of your car keys and that great story idea you had last night are relatively low on the file clerk's priority list, which leads us back to the point of this book and the Runes for Writers system. If you're anything like me, you've misplaced your keys on more than one occasion. You're in a rush for work or a dinner appointment, and poof, gremlins have made off with your keys. You systematically search the house, you retrace your steps since last arriving at home, all to no avail. You rack your ordinary consciousness, intellect, short-term memory, logical processing, in an effort to locate those pesky keys, but nothing seems to work. The problem in this case is that we're using the wrong tool, the wrong level of consciousness for the job. It wasn't the ordinary consciousness that left the keys wherever they might be. It wasn't the intellect, reason, or even emotional choice that hid them. Yet we generally resort to those levels of consciousness to find a solution to the situation created by another. Instead, it's only after you've canceled your plans, sat down on the sofa, and punched up Netflix that the solution appears. You're binging The Last Kingdom, and your subconscious whispers to your ordinary conscious, gee, some ice cream would be great right about now. You may debate this among your various levels of consciousness, but again, if you're anything like me, higher judgment prevails, and you head to the freezer. And there you discover your keys right next to the ice tray where you left them. Now, the point here is that it wasn't the ordinary consciousness that chose to deposit the keys along with the Aldens. And it isn't the ordinary consciousness that can unravel the bizarre yet deliciously satisfying sequence of events that led to their recovery. The same is true with writer's block. It's a common fallacy among creatives that our brilliance is a product of superior intellect, that our genius in its classical meaning arises from the ordinary consciousness. If this were the case, the ordinary consciousness would be the perfect tool for getting unstuck when our stories go off the rails and we have no idea what to write next. The fact of the matter, story arises from the unconscious mind. It actually has its origins outside of any individual human experience, but its appearance within the milieu of the individual storyteller comes through the unconscious mind. From there, as time and diet and other matters of physical survival allow, the subconscious is able to ferry bits and pieces of a particular story into the consciousness of said storyteller. And when those threads of the story taper off, or when the ordinary consciousness has taken over for flow and written itself into a corner, we experience the condition commonly referred to as writer's block, capital letters, italics, boldface, and any other sort of nefarious emphasis with which you want to embellish it. And thus blocked, we typically then turn to the intellect, that agent of the ordinary consciousness, to craft a solution. We storyboard, conduct character interviews, observe and analyze hapless bystanders at the mall or the dog park, and all to no avail because we're enlisting the wrong center of consciousness to resolve the problem. If we want to reconnect to the story, we need to return to its source in the unconscious mind.
And that was Mark Graham reading from Runes for Writers, Boost Your Creativity and Destroy Writer's Block. And how exactly do you do that with these runes? I mean, when you talk about casting runes, what does that actually mean?
Sure. So if any of your listeners are familiar with tarot, it's a very similar process. In fact, these same rune castings or card layouts or tile layouts can be used with ordinary playing cards or tarot cards or whatever you wish. There are a couple of aspects to this. So one is the the ritual aspect you give to it. You may, if you're doing a rune casting, you may wish to light a candle, light some incense, whatever works within your personal space and within your ordinary practices. By setting apart, you know, this is now creative space, this is creative time, that's a signal to your muse and to the unconscious that, oh, hey, you know, Mark is there wanting some story ideas. Let's see what he has to say, what he's up to. And then with the rune cards, in the book, I present three different rune castings. I present a fourth rune casting, which is specific to a set of rune dice that we've developed. And the dice specifically right now I use them for character development. Depending on the complexity of your story problem, we have what I call the web of weird rune casting, which is four cards for scene level, what should happen next or how do I get out of this corner. I have a five elements rune casting, which is more for the act, maybe the scene or act or sequence level, to really understand the forces that are working in your story at a given time. And then the nine worlds rune casting, obviously I've called back to the Norse mythology for the names of all these. But the nine worlds rune casting can really be used to outline, I've used it to outline an entire story. And in psychology terms, really what we're doing with the rune casting, so we're just really creating a framework. I spoke of that notion of the oak tree in Plato's realm of ideas, and that the idea simply grows upon a physical matrix. So we're creating, establishing that physical matrix in our world for these ideas from the unconscious mind to come and take root and settle into the appropriate spots that we've created for them. We send that intention out with our subconscious. We're distracting the left brain as we flip the cards over. You know, the left brain is trying to name them, to identify their pattern, to remember their literal meaning and all these other things. So it's doing what it likes to do. It's categorizing, it's putting into boxes, it's making lists and spreadsheets and all that fun stuff. While the right brain is tuning into the subconscious, which is now going, okay, what is my inciting incident? What are the forces of antagonism in the story? What is the deep, dark moment? And it's bringing back these pieces from the unconscious, dropping them into their slots so that the writer then can really begin brainstorming on, you know, what does it mean that the force of antagonism is, for example, the bad shaman or the failed protector. So it's that interplay between the unconscious and the subconscious that really kind of bring those answers into the physical level. And the runes, again, as I said before, they serve as a mnemonic, as a shorthand for those solutions.
That's really fascinating.
It's fun, and the, you know, at first when this notion first appeared to me, I thought, well, it's neat and I can use it for myself, but will other writers really buy this? And so I've got a great critique group here locally. They were kind enough to give me their time to really workshop this process, and it was uncanny. Several of them were working on stories that they hadn't shared with me yet, so I didn't know enough about the story to fake an answer. And as we did practice these rune castings for their various story issues, it's good we weren't in Salem in the 1600s because I probably wouldn't be able to be on your show.
Wow. So it really, people were getting answers like out of the mists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of like the old, like Ouija board back in the day. Remember, Mom, when we used to do the Ouija board?
Yeah,
yeah,
I do.
Yeah. And it's exactly the same thing, absolutely different purpose, but it's, you know, all of these divinatory systems, they have a common link, and you can use them for obviously many, many different functionalities, but it's the way that they allow that unconscious, and whether it's our own unconsciousness or possibly in the case of Ouija boards, external consciousness, to relay information and communication to us.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mark Graham, author of Runes for Writers, Boost Your Creativity and Destroy Writer's Block.
Okay, now tell me this. If you're, when you're in the midst of this and you're getting ideas from all the things that have come into your subconscious and unconscious, do you ever have more than one story idea at a time?
It can't. Actually, as I was writing or finishing up the edits on the book and looking to develop a series of podcasts or YouTube videos around this, I went into it with the idea of, well, let me do each of these rune castings for a particular story that I have in mind. And I don't know if my muse was not cooperating that day or if I didn't have a clear focus, but the rune casting that I came up with was really more more in line with a personal issue that I was dealing with at the time. I was like, wait a minute, I'm not sharing this with anyone. So I think it's best if you can, and that's also part of the benefit of having a specific place, a time, kind of a ritual that you build around it so that you can be clear and focused. I think it's the rune casting is the unconsciousness deals in specifics. And so if you kind of give mixed messages to the subconscious of what you want your solution for, the answers you get back may be muddled. They're probably accurate if you know which question they're answering. But I find it's best to go in with a very clear, single-minded focus.
Now, Mark, I was going to ask you to describe ways that using this rune system influenced Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, but I think you said that you didn't really come up with the system till after you wrote that book.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
So what did you use for this before? I mean, you must have had other tools that you utilized when you came to an area where you were stuck in your writing.
Yeah, and I think I used most of the tools that every writer falls back on, mostly delaying and doing things other than writing. To date, the three novels I've published, well, the first one took about 8 years. I mean, it's the first novel, so I didn't know what I was doing, but it took about 8 years from idea to publishable work. Song of Songs and Son of the Sea both took 3 or 4 years to draft, and part of that was exactly this process. I would get stuck or derailed, and at that time I would just have to wait for the muse to bring me the inspiration or the solution to the problem. That's a very long process, and it's and particularly if you're, I kind of describe this in the excerpt that I read. If you, the more you intellectually and consciously work a problem, the tougher that shell becomes and the harder it is to crack. It's a lot of the times I'll find a solution to a problem. I'm in the shower, I'm walking the dog, doing anything but trying to solve the problem, is because the intellect has now gotten out of the way. The right brain, the unconscious, are able to work together to pull that solution up. Or when you have a dream, the solution to a problem in a dream, and you wake up and it's like, that's perfect. There's no way I'll forget it.
And then you forget it.
Right.
Exactly. Same with solutions that come during a meditation practice. You often lose those too.
Exactly. and that's part of the, at least for me, part of why I'm really excited about this this tool. So I have a couple of dozen story ideas kicking around in my head, with those ideas, just the rough outlines of what the stories might be. And I can't afford to take 3 to 8 years to write all those. I'll never get finished. So the great thing with the Runes for Writers system is that we don't have to wait on the inspiration. We don't have to wait for the muse to deign to call upon us. We can set the schedule. We can outline the story. We can work through scenes and character development when we choose to, by just going into our creative space, calling on the runes, and casting out for those solutions to the story problems, and get those done in a much shorter time period, much more efficiently than by my old method of just kind of waiting for the solution to appear.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, I understand you're also an engineer.
I am, yeah, a mechanical engineer by day.
By day. So you're still doing that as well as writing.
I am, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So, what made you, did you always want to be a writer too? Or if not, what pushed you in that direction?
You know, I've toyed around with story as long as I can remember. You know, I don't remember learning to read. It's always been a part of my consciousness. I'm sure my mother taught me at some point, but I was so young, I don't have any active memory of that. And so reading and later trying to create stories has always been a part of me. And I wrote some just horrid science fiction when I was young. Out of college, I tried my hand at, you know, some Tom Clancy style thrillers, none of which will see the light of day to protect the innocent reading public. But when I got the idea for Of Ashes and Dust, that was a story idea that just captured my soul and would not let me go until I'd finished that story. And when I finished that and began getting some very positive feedback from professional circles, I knew that, you know, that there was something there. And I have a firm conviction that, you know, obviously with all this notion of creativity, you know, story exists outside of us. And if the muse deigns to whisper in our ear, tap on our shoulder and bring us a particular story, that's a sacred calling. It's a vocation, in the religious sense. And it's, you know, of course we can refuse the call as in any great heroic adventure. But if we accept that call and if we go on that journey of finding the story, not only will our lives change, but we have the potential to create change in the world. And that's a powerful, powerful thing. You know, I couple that, you know, from the, obviously it feels like two very different mindsets. You know, I've always also been a tinkerer and I would take apart things in our home and put them back together and hopefully not have too many pieces left over. And as I went into my formal training and more in my professional practice, you know, engineering is really about problem solving. It's about studying a system, understanding its moving parts, and finding a way to make them work more efficiently. And I think I really bring that, you know, this, the Runes for Writers system really is the combination of those two worlds. It's a mechanical and engineering analysis of story, you know, and creativity. How do they work? What are the moving parts? And the runes are the system of how do we make them work better and more efficiently and serve our needs, our requirements in a better way.
I think my husband was an engineer. He used to call that critical path.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm curious about Of Ashes and Dust, which was your first novel that you published and that was based, that had a Civil War story. You said that idea just grabbed you. What was the kind of base idea of that novel and where did it come from?
So we were living in Richmond, Virginia at the time, the capital of the Confederacy. Not at the time it was the capital, but a friend of mine was studying to be, and this really factors into a lot of my spiritual path as well. You know, at the time I was very much a straight-laced engineer, but a friend of mine was studying to become a regression hypnosis therapist, where through hypnosis, she would take people back through past life encounters to help them understand, you know, their present world, present day circumstances, and to kind of work through those. While I didn't put much stock in that, the notion at the time, you know, she was a friend, she needed X number of practice hours, so sure, I'll be happy to help you out. And in that hour-long session, I encountered this man called Jim Robbins, and with four very distinct episodes from his life, which really formed the foundation for what became of Ashes and Dust. Those scenes are in the book almost as I envisioned them in that initial setting. But that was, you know, an awakening to me that you know, I think part of the reason those early attempts at writing, at storytelling were so bad was because I was doing it from an analytical standpoint, an analytical perspective. And with Of Ashes and Dust, when that story came to me, I realized the story was alive. It wasn't something that I was cobbling together. I was, you know,
you were recording it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was witnessing it, and bringing those events into a page, filling in details around them, you know, taking ideas and giving them shape and form in word and literary structure. But, you know, the idea wasn't, you know, it wasn't me trying to make stuff up. And whether that comes from, you know, I haven't found documentary evidence that Jim Robbins ever existed, so I can't confirm or deny the experience, you know, but at the very least, I was in a state, you know, a slightly altered state of consciousness where I was open to that creative flow, and the notion of that story was able to really just envelop me.
Well, you talked about using Civil War letters as a resource, and we have a trove of Civil War letters from a distant relative that... Mom, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I didn't know this person or anything, but it was interesting to it's interesting to read them and the way that, you know, that they wrote. Did he write in pencil or was it in pen?
It was in pen, but it was pretty faded after all this time. But they're so eloquent, and they're also a little hard to read because the handwriting's has a lot of flourishes and. And also he was trying to squeeze words into the page and you know, ran out of room. But this gentleman was, he wrote one of the letters. He was on a hospital ship in the Bay of Vicksburg during the Battle of Vicksburg.
Mm.
There's another letter that he writes. He was from Iowa, which is where we are. And he's writing about marching through Missouri. And that they would, whenever they'd come across a slave, a black man, that was most, I think it was primarily men, they would say, oh, fall in, well, you can come with us. And that a lot of them, or that some of them would say, oh, I daren't do that. But some of them came. But then when they got back to the Union Army grounds, they weren't allowed to bring him behind the lines and, you know, bring him into the camp. And so they collected money and gave him directions north and sent him on their way.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Monica, you should write a book about that.
I've been writing. It's on my list. It's definitely on my list. It's so inspiring. So, Mark, how were you... how did you find your publisher then for Of Ashes and Dust?
So the novel had been in my drawer for actually several years. You know, when I first thought I had completed the novel, again, it was my first endeavor into long form storytelling. I had this gorgeous piece of work that was, epic storytelling and creative time twists and 160,000 words long, and I had no idea it was totally unpublishable. So once I learned that, I went back to the drawing board, rewrote it, cut out half the verbiage, put it in more of a linear story form and begin winning awards from it. So I then understood what it took to be a commercial storyteller. But even then, historical fiction is a tough market. And after, you know, several, at least a couple hundred rejections from agents, tucked it away in the drawer, started on the next story. And then several years ago, we were at a writers conference here in Denver with Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers. And lovely young woman from Five Star Publishing was there to kind of scout out the talent. I had nearly forgotten that the story existed at this point. And she, Five Star primarily focuses in Westerns and in mysteries, and not really much of any other genres. So I thought, well, I'm not writing a Western, so I don't have anything, to really talk with her about. But one of our critique group partners, had grabbed a table at dinner. And Tiffany Schofield with the Five Star happened to be hosting that table, which is a great thing about conferences. I mean, you've got the opportunity to meet professionals in the industry who are very generous with their time and their insights. And so she was hosting the table to answer any of those questions about her line specifically or about the publishing world in general. My wife sat next to her and began a conversation, and somehow Hell on Wheels, the Anson Mount series, came up, and both of them were, you know, swooning over Anson Mount. And my wife mentioned, by the way, my husband Mark has a novel that, you know, has that Transcontinental Railroad tie-in, the Civil War. And we began talking. I told her about my pathway and the you know, the feedback I'd gotten from rather big time agents was, love the story, don't know how to sell it. And she says, well, I know how to sell it. Send it to me. And so that was my first successful foray, I guess, into publishing.
Wow. And did you stay with that publisher for your later books?
I did not, since they are very focused in their genres. My other two books were not really good matches for their catalog. But I was at another writers' conference with the Historical Novel Society, and ran across a woman with Blank Slate Press, and caught up with her, began telling her about my stories, and you know it's. This fascinating turn of events in the publishing industry, whether you still want to go mainstream, big five, you want an independent but smaller mid-sized publisher, or if you're choosing to go indie, you know, it's really understanding the industry and just going out and making contacts and connections. I'd actually met Christy Blank McKenzie at a previous conference and didn't think much of it at the time, but when I met her again, something clicked, and so I asked her if I could buy her a drink and pick her brain about the industry. And by the time we were done, she had requested both of my then manuscripts, which have now become Song of Songs and Son of the Sea, Daughter of the Sun, which both came out last year.
Well, congratulations. And I think we're about out of time.
So okay.
It's been a great pleasure having you with us today.
It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on.
Mom, do you have some closing words?
Yes, this is actually a quote from the book. He says, "Story has the power to transform lives and shape our world. The world needs your story and your unique way of presenting it. Story has chosen you to share the laughter, the inspiration, the enjoyment, and the message that only you can give. Go forth and be glorious."
Aw, thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.